It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at the influence of Frank Lloyd Wright on the architect's 150th birth anniversary. First, Governor Walker wants to make Wisconsin the first state in the country to drug test people who apply for Medicaid health benefits. The testing would focus on childless and able-bodied adults. The governor's plan to drug test recipients of public benefits has been controversial. Opponents have argued that the move is expensive and maybe even immoral. Supporters say it ultimately lends a helping hand to people struggling with addiction. Jason Stein joins us now. He covers the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, spell out the specifics of this plan to drug test certain Medicaid health applicants.
Sure. I mean, there's many, many aspects to it, but I think it comes down to, in a nutshell, that the state will run screening questions to childless adults applying for Medicaid if they're able-bodied. And if they, you know, sort of quote-unquote fail that portion of it, they'll be asked to take a drug test. And if they refuse or if they take the drug test and fail, they'll have to do treatment. If they refuse treatment, then they won't be eligible for Badger Care.
So not all Medicaid applicants would be tested, not even all Medicaid applicants in this category of childless, able-bodied adults. There's first that questionnaire.
Correct. Presumably, you know, the questionnaire would have questions such as, you know, have you been convicted of a drug offense, or, you know, questions along those lines that might tease out people that would be at a higher likelihood of using drugs at the time.
Now, this is something, as we've talked about in the past, the state can't do on its own. We would need some kind of approval from the federal government. What would the governor need to get?
He would need to get a waiver from President Trump's administration that would essentially let the state waive the normal federal rules that are in effect. And again, you know, it's worth noting that, as you said, that there is no other state that has done this for Medicaid. It's been done for other public benefit programs, but because healthcare is at times a life and death situation, it's particularly sensitive in the case of Medicaid.
Is it anticipated that the Trump administration would give a thumbs up here?
You know, I really don't know the answer to that, Rob. I mean, we are also asking for the ability to charge premiums to certain childless adults. That is something that Vice President Mike Pence's administration did when he was governor of Indiana. And one of the consultants who was very instrumental in that measure there is now the head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. So in that case, you would certainly expect the Trump administration to approve it. But because the drug testing is so unusual, it's hard to say.
Talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the governor's plans to have drug testing for certain Medicaid applicants, a written screening, and then drug testing for some people in the category of childless and able-bodied adults. Jason, what has been the argument from Governor Walker and others who support this idea?
You know, what the governor has said is that I think the state's unemployment rate is just a little bit above 3%. So employers are having more difficulty finding workers. The governor thinks that addiction is one barrier to work and is arguing that this program could get people into treatment and into the workforce. You know, I think it's worth noting that we have yet to see the empirical evidence of that. A similar testing regime in the Wisconsin Works W-2 program, the Welfare to Work program, you know, so far has not really produced anyone that has made it through drug testing.
Right, but Governor Walker has been emphasizing the point that, you know, this isn't a matter of you fail a drug test, you don't get Medicaid assistance, that addiction treatment would be the next step, or at least the availability of addiction treatment.
Correct, and the administration has softened its proposal somewhat along these lines. The governor initially said that if you refused treatment. His administration wanted to keep you off Badger Care for 6 months. Now the proposal would be such that even if you refuse treatment, you could reconsider, accept treatment, and go on Badger Care at any time.
What have critics been saying about this proposal?
I think the main thing they say is that there's no evidence it would work. Again, in other states and in the W-2 program, the drug testing has turned up relatively few people who are using drugs. And then, again, the treatment so far has not been, accepted in large numbers or effective in large numbers in the W-2 program. The other thing they say is that there's an argument that, is likely to be made in federal court eventually that this is a legal search and seizure by the government that's unconstitutional.
Let's bring on a caller. We've got Mark on the line in Green Bay. Mark, hi.
Yeah, I just wondered how this might affect people who suffer from chronic alcoholism, when the doctors know about it and stuff.
Mark, thanks for the call. Does this restrict itself, as far as we know, Jason, to illegal drugs?
That's certainly the primary target here. There's certainly the possibility that would be that would also come into play. I think the difficulty is that the mere presence of alcohol in the blood is not a marker of alcoholism per se. So there would have to be some further testing regime or screening regime, I think, to make that possible.
So what is the timeline on this, looking ahead now that this request has been made by the governor?
Rob, I believe it's 75 days for the federal government to respond to Wisconsin's request for a waiver, and a minimum of 75 days, I should say. And then once we get an answer from the federal government, would be at least a year for the state to actually implement the testing. And, there still needs to be some legislative sign-off in the state house as well.
And have Republicans in the legislature been on board so far with this idea?
In concept, certainly, yes. It's not out of the question that they may object to some of the details of the proposal, but I think it's very likely that they'll embrace the lion's share of it.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
That's Jason Stein. He covers the state capitol for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's formal request to the Trump administration to allow drug testing of certain people who apply for Medicaid. Coming up from Taliesin to the Guggenheim, we explore the pioneering style of architect Frank Lloyd Wright on the 150th anniversary of his birth. Stay with us here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how one pastor found spirituality not in a church, but on two wheels. First, today marks the 150th birth anniversary of the legendary Wisconsin architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Wright set up an architectural campus in the Wyoming Valley near Spring Green, where he built his celebrated home, Taliesin, along with a school of architecture and a school for children. Today, the site serves as an active campus with visitors arriving from around the world to tour Wright's home and masterpiece, Taliesin. Later, Wright added a new structure, Taliesin West, in Arizona, and he designed a lot of other famous buildings, things like the Guggenheim Museum, the Johnson Wax Museum, and the home Falling Water. Wright was born 150 years ago, but his influence lives on in the buildings we live and work in today, from the concept of open floor plans to the idea of integrating a building within the landscape. Eric Flesch joins us now. He's an architectural designer who trained at Taliesin, the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture. He's also director of development at Taliesin Preservation. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us on this special occasion for you.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, growing up, if you asked me to name one scientist, I would have said Einstein. One soccer player, I probably would have said Pele. One architect, Frank Lloyd Wright. What is it about what he did and his style that made him the first architect people think of?
He was born shortly after the Civil War, and much like the early Americans focused on the Declaration of Independence. He was rooted in nature like the American Transcendentalists in a way that he could tell the American story like no one else through new forms, new patterns, new styles of buildings that people had never seen. He lived a ripe long life as well, lived to be nearly 92 all through the 50s. And so people just love this interesting modernist who is rooted in the language of American tradition, but forms that they'd never seen.
And the idea of rooting his architecture in the landscape, as I understand it, as a non-expert on architecture, a building he built in this one spot, he wouldn't have built in another spot. He would not do a cookie-cutter thing that could work anywhere.
You're right. He was a champion of context, whether it was in the city or in a rural location. By using patterns of geometry and things that you would find abstractions from nature, you would create a kind of a fabric that relates any kind of the man-built environment to a natural site or to a social fabric.
It's like a building almost that flows out of nature, it seems like, when you look at it, a lot of his designs.
You're absolutely right, and he described as being appropriate for time, place, and the nature of man, and the individual spirit.
Let's talk about what I think is probably his most famous project here in Wisconsin, Taliesin, I mentioned already, in Spring Green. When you approached Taliesin for the first time yourself, what struck you about seeing this building?
It was the stonework. It was the way that we took that local driftless area, sandstone and limestone, and created these ledges, these pop-outs in the walls that allowed the craftsmen to be creative for the first time in their life to create an abstraction of what you see actually in the quarry wall.
It allowed the craftsmen to be creative. Was it fun for people to work with Frank Lloyd Wright in that way, that they could do expressive things that they probably wouldn't do with another architect?
So many people I've met say that working with Wright changed their lives.
Wow.
People who are creative learn to be have a more practical understanding of construction, farming, and some of the building trades. And then a lot of people who are familiar with the trades learn to be creative and to discover culture, the music, art, world ideas like from Japan and Germany, things that were new to rural Wisconsin in their day.
So, and Frank Lloyd Wright was not just, it sounds like, inspired by the American landscape. He was looking around the world for inspiration and ideas to translate over here.
Yeah, you're right. You know, he, having been from the Midwest, first built for the prairie, gently sloping roofs, broad overhanging eaves, emphasizing materials and color palettes that were appropriate for the prairie. So a lot of people remember him for the prairie school of design. But he later realized that the prairie was just the first step on discovering an organic architecture that could be appropriate for any context, any place.
Now, we're sitting in a building that I've heard described as the new brutalism. Basically, if we can do a thing with concrete, we'll do it and kind of defy nature by it. I don't like this building. Is there a conflict in the architectural world between ideas like Wright talked about and the building we're sitting in right now?
Well, totally. There are some features of this building that are interesting, but it's certainly not Wrightian. And Frank Lloyd Wright would have done some things that could perhaps tune the building better to its to the site. I've seen a couple of homes just driving in this morning that had aluminum foil curtains on some of the windows because the orientation of the building was to the south or to the west that would allow blaring light to come screaming in a way that Wright would have been much more sensitive to. So that's just one thing that Wright would have done, is tuned better to the light, the breezes, et cetera, the views.
Now, Taliesin, the most famous Wright building in Wisconsin, by no means the only one. Can you talk about some of his other designs that we can see around the state?
Absolutely. Well, right here in Madison, the Unitarian Meeting House, so beautiful in the great prow window that looks out over the landscape in a stylized way. All the way to Racine, I would say the Johnson Wax Administration Building, perhaps one of the greatest works of architecture of all time, of those dendriform columns where you feel that you're under an abstract Carnauba palm forest in Brazil, just when Mr. Johnson, who founded the wax empire, flew over it in a small aircraft, and you can live that, basically in that administrative space every day. And then, of course, the Research Tower that was built 10 years later with these great cantilevered floors in a tower that's merely framed in tubes of Pyrex glass.
You said of all time there, and I was waiting for in Wisconsin or in the Midwest or by Frank Lloyd Wright. You ended with a period there, of all time, one of the greatest architectural designs.
Absolutely. And, you know, Taliesin, it's not just one building, but a series of 8 buildings and 800 acres of designed landscapes that connects the buildings to one another and to the Driftless area landscape. The earliest one was he was just a draftsman at 18 years old, and then he had his first independent commission with AIR, the first time that he experienced the destruction of the box and creating whole new structures, the use of the cantilever, Prairie Home, the Great Barn. If you ever wanted to see a barn designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, you would do that at Taliesin. And, of course, his rambling home that would have had a place for the chickens, a place for the cows, a place for workmen, as well as for the private residents.
Going back to his early years, you know, sometimes you hear the story of, I mean, I think we can throw the word genius around here. I don't think that would be hyperbole. But you hear the story of the genius, and sometimes it's, wow, everybody recognized this genius right away, or they rejected him, these ideas were nuts. What was the reaction to Frank Lloyd Wright when he first started designing?
Well, he was on the one hand both beloved, embraced, but there were always some people who would have been irritated by forms they had never seen before, and this just this independent streak. You know, his grandparents were Unitarian ministers, and the family motto was truth against the world. And so it was this vision that what's right, each person has an ability to figure that out on their own, and if somebody else doesn't agree with it, well, that doesn't matter. You just sort of keep on going.
That can be very inspiring, and it could probably make it hard to make friends in some cases.
Absolutely, and there were some people that he maybe didn't get along with, but the fact is that he just was surrounded by young people, people of all ages who just wanted to be near him, and in fact, in the 1930s, he started a school of architecture that still exists today. And some people who are still living at Taliesin and Taliesin West have been with Wright since the 1930s and 40s and 50s.
Talking to Eric Flesch, he was trained at Taliesin, the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture. He's Director of Development at Taliesin Preservation. We're talking about Frank Lloyd Wright on the 150th birth anniversary of the legendary Wisconsin-based architect. Let's go beyond Wisconsin's borders now a little bit, Eric. Talk about some of your other, you can go personal if you want, your personal favorite Wright designs around the country, around the world.
Unity Temple outside Chicago is one of my favorite works of architecture, also a work of concrete, but done in such a very light and open way that it's amazing. There's some spaces at Taliesin West and out in California. La Miniatura, also a concrete block house poured with open voids that are shaped like nature patterns so that a concrete house is illuminated with light. These are just some marvels that Wright designed that you wonder how he ever did it.
And Falling Water is one that people throw around a lot in Pennsylvania, is that right?
You know, Falling Water, you know, it might be described as a metaphysical house. You know, you just feel the spirit of nature there in such a bold and abstract way. Maybe it's worth mentioning the Imperial Hotel in Japan. The Sauk City, Sauk Prairie Dam, just celebrated its centennial a couple of years ago. It was famous in its time in the Wisconsin River for being built on wood piles right there in the sand. And Wright translated that same idea to an earthquake-prone Tokyo and built this hotel that survived a famous earthquake, and in World War II was the where the American troops were based.
Now, he did a lot in his time, trained a lot of people. If I were to go to architecture school, and I don't think I'd survive architecture school from what I understand, but if I were, would I still be learning about Frank Lloyd Wright?
You sure would, but you'd also be learning to observe nature with your own eyes, all of your senses, and to design something that's appropriate for the context, time, place, and man today.
Right. I wouldn't start by saying, oh, here's a Frank Lloyd Wright design. I'm going to replicate that over here, because that would defeat the whole point.
At Taliesin, the idea is to have more experience, less history, but you often find that to the extent that Wright was rooting things in timeless principles of nature and geometry, why they seem awfully contemporary even today.
And so as people are designing buildings now, what kind of things happen now that wouldn't have happened without Wright?
Well, the idea of having large spans of glass in which you're moving the structure away from the wall itself with simple post and beam construction, having large chimney masses that could become the center of the family, toning the building to views, to the orientation of the sun, to the direction of the breeze. These are things that Wright originated right here in Madison, a solar hemicycle house in which it was oriented to the south to get just the right kind of sunlight and even to prevent the yard from filling with too much snow.
And this is, as we mentioned, this is a celebration day, a birth anniversary, 150th. What kind of things are you at Taliesin Preservation doing to mark this occasion?
Well, on June 17th, a right celebration for kids, author and entertainer Bob Kahn, is just on Father's Day weekend, is going to be filling the Hillside Theater with juggling, with helping kids understand principles of the cantilever and the nature patterns on the wall. And after that, everybody enjoys a slice of Frank Lloyd Wright's favorite birthday cake. Which is a sponge cake cobbled together with strawberry jam, smothered with whipped cream and drizzled with chocolate sauce and decorated with edible flowers.
And it doesn't have any weird cantilevering itself, the cake.
It just tastes really good.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
And what else is going on?
Well, the Hillside Theater is going to be filled with music all summer long. Rural Musicians Forum will be playing there in June and July, as well as Madison's own Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society, which is fantastic, will be playing there. And there's going to be actually a member of the Taliesin Fellowship has commissioned a brand new composition from a Madison composer that will be debuted by the Taliesin Community Chorus.
Wow.
And this is going to be something that, you know, you might plan your trip out to go to American Players Theater just around the corner out in rural Spring Green. Maybe you have some time outdoors at Governor Dodge State Park. Go see the art scene at Mineral Point. And then come and, in addition to having a tour at Taliesin, stay for some musical performances in the evenings or join one of the programs, like a photography workshop, Chinese brush painting, and more.
As we start to wrap up, thinking about architecture the way Frank Lloyd Wright did changes the way we build and design. Did studying this change the way you look at the world, even outside of design and architecture?
You know, my path to architecture was to first study geology. So
really?
Frank Lloyd Wright's organic architecture did certainly change the way I looked at the world. It changes each person in a slightly different way. But basically, to think about the architecture of the Earth's crust, you know, only at Taliesin would that be relevant. And as a result, you end up creating these humane spaces that are just the right scale for the human being, that doesn't make you feel dwarfed or insignificant in the universe, but rather lifts you up and recognizes the thing that makes you, you, your family special, and, you know, recognize our special life in, you know, under the Declaration of Independence.
So he's worth studying even for those of us who are not designers and architects.
Well, not only can you get a master's in architecture at the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture, but you can send your children, starting in third grade all the way up through high school, to start to learn about the design process, even 3D digital design, model building, even how to design a colony on Mars, all through Taliesin Preservation. So you can learn all about that at taliesinpreservation.org.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
So nice to be here.
That's Eric Flesch, architectural designer. He trained at Taliesin. He's also director of development at Taliesin Preservation. He joined us to talk about the influence of Frank Lloyd Wright on the architect's 150th birth anniversary. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the spirituality of riding a bike. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. First, state and federal laws set drinking water standards to protect public health. Wisconsin residents on municipal systems may think that means their water is always safe to drink. But researchers say viruses are finding their way into water sources undetected, and climate change could make things worse. Danielle Kading has more on the next installment in WPR's State of Change series.
A city well in Washburn is pumping 323 gallons of water a minute up the hill to the city's reservoir. That's according to city water operator Ross Leitner. Washburn has two wells that provide drinking water to about 900 households. The city is among 56 municipal water utilities statewide that don't regularly disinfect their drinking water. Leitner says the city meets state standards by testing for what's called total coliform bacteria.
We meet our bacterial levels without having to disinfect. We test three times a month required by the DNR.
The tests reveal any problems that may exist in a drinking water system or well. If tests don't reveal anything, Leitner says there's no need to disinfect.
Wisconsin DNR is telling us that we don't have to, so if we don't have to chlorinate our water, it's kind of, you know, why would you kind of thing, you know?
Makes sense, but Chris Uejo thinks they should. He says one reason is the link he's researching between rainfall and illness. The assistant geography professor at Florida State University studied the rate of stomach illness among kids in northern Wisconsin communities that do and don't disinfect their drinking water.
And in these areas where they were treating their drinking water, we did not find any systematic relationship between rainfall and new human illnesses. But we did find a pretty systematic and consistent relationship in these communities in northern Wisconsin that were accessing municipal water that was untreated.
Simply put, rain is transporting viruses that make people sick into drinking water sources. Using climate models, UASIO's study shows young kids in those communities will be more likely to fall ill from untreated drinking water as the area sees more frequent intense rainfall due to climate change.
We found a pretty modest increase due to climate change.
UASIO says that ranged anywhere from a 1 to 2% increase in the rate of stomach illnesses. Wisconsin Geological Survey hydrogeologist Madeline Gotkowitz says communities that don't treat their water aren't doing anything wrong. They're just following state standards.
But the way a lot of people interpret that is if their well passes the total coliform test, then the water must be safe to drink.
But those tests don't look for the presence of viruses that UASIO says are making people sick. USDA Agricultural Research Service microbiologist Mark Borkart says a 2007 study revealed pathogens could penetrate layers of rock thought to filter out contamination.
When it rains, people should understand that's when contamination happens. So many people have this view of groundwater being ancient and deep and coming from an underground river, and actually a lot of it's just the rain that fell on the ground 2 weeks earlier.
The findings swayed the Wisconsin DNR to revise its drinking water rules so that all municipal water utilities would have to disinfect, but the legislature nixed that requirement in 2011. Opponents argued local governments should decide whether to treat their water. They pointed to added costs for cash-strapped communities and even taste. Washburn City Administrator Scott Kluver says they get quite a few complaints from residents when they have to disinfect their drinking water.
There's usually a line of people trying to fill up water at the artesian well because they don't like the smell or the taste of the chlorine.
But UASIO says his study found that treating drinking water would prevent 82% of stomach illnesses associated with rainfall in communities that don't regularly disinfect. As Wisconsin sees hotter, wetter weather, those communities may see residents lining up more often at the doctor's office instead and paying more out of pocket to treat illnesses that could have been prevented. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project here at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change. Now, when it comes to finding spiritual inspiration and enlightenment, there are a lot of places people like to look. Churches, meditation retreats, nature, trips around the world, a few common options. But sometimes that inspiration strikes you where at least you least expect it. For our next guest, it came on two wheels. Laura Everett, a pastor in Boston, discovered bicycling after her car broke down for good one night. She turned to the bicycle as a way to get around, but what she discovered was something deeper. In a new book, she describes her conversion to urban cycling, how it brought her closer to the city she called home, and how people can channel their inner spirituality just by hopping on for a ride. Laura Everett joins us now. She's a minister in the United Church of Christ and the executive director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. Her new book is Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. Laura, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, talk us through the beginning of the story. A broken down car ends you on this biking quest for spirituality.
That's right. I was driving a beat-up old car down 93 South, just outside of Boston, and it finally died, and I was fresh out of seminary, too economically strapped to replace it, and I happened to be in a Bible study at the time with some other women who were asking how to be more faithful with our money, how to spend less and give more, and I showed up that next week, and my car has died. And they said, first, you can't afford a new car. And then secondly, they said, we think you can ride a bicycle, and we'll teach you how. And so I had these wonderful bike lady Sherpas help me build my first bike and then learn how to ride in the city.
And a lot of people think twice about riding a bike in a big city, Boston, pretty good sized city. Were you a little nervous getting started?
Oh, sure. I am not actually from Boston. I grew up in suburban New Jersey. So for me, a bicycle was a kid's toy. It was entertainment or something that you did for pleasure or for exercise. But I didn't think of it really as a vehicle. And city cycling felt really intimidating to me. That's why it was so wonderful that friends and neighbors taught me how to ride. And I know many cities have learned to ride programs because many of us just don't think about bicycles as our primary form of transit.
It ended up being bigger than that, though. It became your primary mode of transit, but it became something more. When did you start to realize that there was more to biking than just getting from point A to point B?
I think it was probably the second year that I was riding. You know, it took a while for this to become my regular practice. But then it didn't take as much thought, as much planning. I could just kind of get on my bike and go. And I realized that what you do daily shapes you. What you do daily shapes you. It shapes your body. It shapes our cities. It shapes our spirits. And I was developing a different kind of relationship with my city because I was riding through it. I had a different sense of my body because my legs could take me somewhere. I had a different sense of my neighbors because I could actually see them.
Talk about that different sense of your city. Because, yeah, I think we've all had the experience if we drive or mass transit or whatever, you get in here, you get out there, and you don't really experience the between part. What is it that you saw from on your bike?
Yeah, I think that's just right. Whether on a subway line or in a car, you're enclosed in some sort of way. And the trip just becomes the way to get in between two places. But on a bicycle, the ride is part of the journey. And there's something about the speed of the bicycle, I think. You're going fast enough for it to be efficient, but slow enough that you actually see what's around you. And certainly on a bicycle, you're not encased, which both can have people feeling a little more vulnerable, but it also means that you see what's around you. So this morning on my commute in, I saw a gaggle of small children heading to the park, and I rang my bell a bunch of times and waved, and I was like the most impressive superhero they saw all day. So that sense of like actually being able to interact with your neighbors because you're not separated from them.
And you talk in the book, and it's actually even in your title, the idea of urban spirituality. And I think in Christianity and a lot of other traditions, if you want to connect with your spirituality, you want to get to nature. The big city isn't the place you look for that spiritual connection necessarily. You don't buy that, though.
No. I mean, I think you're right. There's definitely a trend that says we find the transcendent. And frankly, in many religious traditions and folks who don't identify with just one, have this sense that, like, to be spiritually wise is to go to the mountains or go to the lake or the ocean and find something transcendent in the isolation. But for those of us who follow the Christian scriptures, we're a people whose story starts in a garden but ends in a city. The heavenly vision in Revelation is urban, a new heaven and a new earth. But the way we talk about transcendence acts like you gotta go to the wilderness to find God. And so I thought for those of us who love cities, or for those of us who can't leave cities, how are we supposed to find the transcendent here?
And when you started to embrace the bicycle as a mode of transportation and a window to spirituality, you started to minister not just to your own congregation, but to your fellow bicyclists. Can you talk about what kind of things you started to do?
Well, it's a pretty wonderful thing to be connected to a community of practical cyclists, all these people from different walks of life, races, economic backgrounds, ethnicities, who also either by choice or by necessity ride their bike. And so you start to see the same people every day at the same intersections. And I felt like we got to know one another a little bit. And I thought I was being kind of funny, and I stuck the clergy placard that was supposed to go on my car, and I zip-tied it to the back of my bicycle. So people sort of knew who I was. And I think you all have seen some of this in Milwaukee anyway, that when a cyclist is killed, there's a tradition in the cycling community of installing a ghost bike, a white bicycle placed at the scene of the crash so that the person who has died might be made visible, because cyclists really have an embodied sense of their vulnerability as transit users. America is definitely designed primarily for cars in many places. And so the ghost bike is a reminder that we have vulnerable transit users and we need to keep an eye out for them. As we had more and more people riding in Boston, and unfortunately, as there were a few more fatalities, the cycling community gathered to dedicate these ghost bikes, and I helped facilitate and lead a lot of our ghost bike dedications here. But we also get together once a year to have a blessing of the bicycles, too. It's beautiful.
We're talking right now with Laura Everett. She's a minister in the United Church of Christ. She's in Boston. She's the author of the new book, Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. She says cycling can be a great way to get to know your neighbors, your city, and yourself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel inspired, even enlightened, after a ride on your bike? What can cycling teach us about our surroundings and ourselves? What is important to you about riding on a bike? What view does it give you on the world you live in? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up our conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking right now with Laura Everett. She's a minister in the United Church of Christ, the author of Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you think cycling can teach us about our surroundings and ourselves? Have you drawn inspiration from cycling or another similar humble activity? Has it actually changed you? Have you connected with your spirituality in an unexpected place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Laura, I want to introduce another character from your book, Brother Lawrence. Can you tell us about him and how he inspired you?
Yeah. So Brother Lawrence is a Catholic monk. He joined a French monastery in 1632 after he had a vision of a dead tree out in winter, and he looked out and he saw the possibility of spring. And so he made his way to a monastery. He spent a significant portion of his life peeling potatoes. Best we know, he worked in the monastery kitchen. But he compiled this. We have his collective writings called The Practice of the Presence of God. And it's a touchstone for spiritual practice and mindfulness. And I, in trying to make sense of how my daily commute was shaping me, I turned to Brother Lawrence, who also found the possibility of mindfulness and a regular conversation with God amid the clatter of pans and the annoying practices of his brother monks.
Yeah, how do we calibrate ourselves to that kind of awareness, I guess, whether we're riding a bike or peeling potatoes for the rest of the monks or whatever other humble activity?
Right. Well, I find inspiration from monastic communities who often would call this practice a rule of life. It was a set of norms and patterns that govern their communal living. And I think cyclists have that. Practical cyclists, those of us who ride daily as our primary means of transit, have a sort of discipline that any pastor would give her right arm for, a discipline and a dedication of how they will move intentionally through the world. And my hope with Holy Spokes was to tease out what is happening to us, our spirits, our community, our sense of ourself in our cities as we ride through.
Talking to Laura Everett. Her new book is Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. She talks about her conversion to urban bicycling and how it changed her view of the world, spirituality, and the people around her. Laura, a lot of people, if they're going to set out to do urban bicycling, might think, okay, but I'm going to avoid what I see as a sketchy, maybe dangerous neighborhood. That's something you tried not to do. Why?
Right. Well, I think an intentional practice of border crossing is part of what shapes us to be good neighbors. It turns out that to be committed to that whole love thy neighbor thing is actually easier when you see your neighbors. So by cars or by bus, sometimes we just rush through neighborhoods that are unfamiliar to us. But by bicycle, we can slow down, see what's actually happening, notice the parks, notice the neighbors, notice the shops, notice communities that we might not see otherwise.
I want to bring on a caller now. We have Jen on the line in Madison at 800-642-1234. Jen, hi.
Hi, Rob.
What did you want to tell us about, Jen?
So I do find bicycling a very meditative exercise. For me, the kind of rhythmic, repetitive, circular pedal stroke that you have to do just to kind of keep yourself going, that kind of gets me in a very meditative mind state. You know, you're also in a very vulnerable environment. So all that kind of mixed together, I find to be very meditative.
Jen, thanks so much for sharing that. Does that match up with your experience, Laura?
Oh, absolutely. Jen, that's beautiful. And that's my experience on a bike as well. You know, when a route becomes familiar enough that you can just go, and there's a sense of a heightened awareness. And in my experience, that time on my bike is when my anxiety, the sort of chatter in my mind, filters down, and I can start noticing what is most important, what is really nagging me. But yeah, there's something about that regular rhythm of pedaling that allows my mind to settle and maybe even to transcend what is most present in front of me.
Jen, thanks for that call. Laura, you also talk about biking in Boston as a way to learn to manage anger of yourself and of others. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, maybe drivers in Wisconsin are kinder than ones in Boston. We've got quite a reputation here, but I don't know about you all, but our rush hour is ripe for some spiritual maturity. You know, we're competitive. We're not kind. We're mean and aggressive on the road. We behave on roads in ways that we would never do in the grocery store, in line at the post office, rushing to lights and cutting people off. And so as a vulnerable transit user, cyclists need to notice what's going on around them and both claim the dignity of our own space, that we are allowed to be on the road, but also to recognize that there are actors that are much bigger than us. And so how you deal with other people's anger is important on the road and a practice I take off it as well.
So you've gotten better about not being angry at the drivers, even if they're insensitive?
I'm working on it.
Okay.
I think I really hope that pedestrians and cyclists and drivers remember that we're all just humans trying to make it home alive. I believe seriously in proportional responsibility. If you're driving a 1,000-pound vehicle that could do enormous damage to a vulnerable transit user, I ask and pray that you do not drive distracted. Leave the text, leave the phone call, leave your sandwich for another time, because the person on the bike, you know, we're just trying to get home to our family too.
Laura, just a few moments left. Leave us with a bit of encouragement to someone out there thinking of getting their bike tuned up and giving this a shot.
Oh, I am happy to be a bicycle evangelist. Look, there is a good life on two wheels. And for those of you who haven't ridden in a long time, maybe this is a call to try again or invite somebody else to teach you how. Think about if there is an upcoming trip in your life that is less than 5 miles, pretty close by, and could you take a bicycle to do it? Remember to pump up your tires, put on your helmets and your lights. Notice the people in the world around you. Find the strength in your own legs and the wind in your face. I hope you have a joyful time on your bike.
Laura, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
That's Laura Everett. She's a minister in the United Church of Christ. She's in Boston. She's the executive director of the Massachusetts Council of Churches. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. You can find out more about that and share your stories on the Central Time Facebook page. There's yet another in a long line of movie remakes. This is kind of a big one, I guess, though, one I wouldn't have expected. Mary Poppins. I just saw some info and sneak peek pictures from Mary Poppins Returns due out next year. More of a sequel, I guess, than a remake. Same basic concept, though. It'll have Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins. It also includes Lin-Manuel Miranda, a.k.a. the Hamilton guy, Angela Lansbury, Meryl Streep, and I think this is the big piece of news here, Mr. Dick Van Dyke from the original. You heard the response from Michelle Good back there. Not as far as I could tell, Julie Andrews, though. But a lot of people there. I don't know. Public radio seems to draw Dick Van Dyke fans. One of our former colleagues was almost obsessed with him. But remakes, it's always, and reboots of older movies. And this is one that's really beloved. It always raises that question. Can we just stick with the original, or is there a reason to have another go at it for a new generation? I don't feel super strongly myself. I'm not too worked up about it, not too attached to the original, but we'd like you to share your thoughts right now. Do we need another Mary Poppins? Tell us what you think on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time.
Now as the ladder of life has been strung, you might think a sweep's on the bottom most rung. Though I spends me time in the ashes and smoke, in this all wide world there's no happier bloke.